From Washington, VOA presents Issues in the News.
Welcome to Issues in the News. On the panel this week, Philippe Gelee, U.S. Chief Correspondent for Le Figaro, and Michael Williams, CBS Radio News contributor. Our moderator is Washington Bureau Chief for The Economist, David Rennie.
And here are the issues in the news. The leaders of 30 Muslim nations gathered in Turkey to rebuke Donald Trump for recognizing Jerusalem as the capital city of Israel. A failed suicide bombing by a Bangladeshi man in New York City prompted Donald Trump to demand tougher immigration laws, including an end to visas for family members of existing lawful migrants. Republican fears of being dragged down by anti-Trump sentiment were stoked after a Democrat won a Senate seat in the deeply conservative southern state of Alabama. And in Washington, members of Congress squabbled fiercely over alleged political bias among federal investigators probing whether Russian spies meddled in the 2016 election. So let's begin with the response in the Middle East to a decision that was signaled for a long time, that Donald Trump promised that he would recognize Jerusalem as the capital of Israel. He said, in fact, during the campaign that he would move the American embassy sort of on day one of being president to Jerusalem. It's obviously something that he's not the first American leader to promise this. It's been something Congress has pushed for a long time. And yet, Philippe, when he made that decision, there was still, I think, not just dismay from countries that have always been hostile to American policy. You saw some American allies in the region also really not happy with this announcement. What was the pushback?
Well, if you look for the upside of this decision, what is it helping exactly? What kind of American national interest or diplomatic objective does it fulfill? I still haven't heard anything on that front. What we can see is that it pleases evangelicals, allies of Donald Trump here in the U.S. The only diplomatic result, if indeed the member states of the Islamic group and Muslim and Arab countries basically recognize Jerusalem or Al-Quds as the capital of the Palestinian state, it's a kind of way of neutralizing the support that the United States is trying to give to Israel. So we are stuck in an even deeper hole, I think, on this issue. The only result that I can see and is that what may make sense on the part of the President of the United States is that he's maybe trying to lower the expectations of the Palestinians in any peace negotiation. Mm-hmm. And by showing that, I mean, you won't have our back, our support on this issue of the capital. So,
Michael, Philippe uses a very interesting word about sort of neutralizing the effect of the declaration on Israel. And I guess what that really sort of points to is that for a very long time, there has been a sense that America gains sort of authority in the Middle East context by pursuing a sort of policy that's at least officially about balance, that America is not 100% on the side of Israel, it's not 100% on the side of the Palestinians, it doesn't actually take a view as to how Jerusalem one day might be divided. You've also seen this tradition that Israeli diplomats here in Washington have always said they didn't want support for Israel to be a Republican issue or a Democratic issue. Again, they always wanted that kind of balance, that it was something that all political parties supported Israel. Is that sense of balance really being disrupted right now?
Yes, pretty clearly. Well, let's go from the world stage first. The United States has set itself over the years as an quote-unquote honest broker when it comes to negotiating the peace between the two parties. And when you come down so heavily on one side, it's very difficult to say that you are an honest and fair and impartial broker. You're clearly partial to one side. And as Philippe says, maybe that's the point, is to say that this is where we stand and this is the point from which you're going to negotiate Palestinians if there's going to be any type of peace. Which, again, this is sort of the heavy-handed sort of negotiation, militaristic, that sort of Trumpism is kind of based on when it comes to a diplomatic policy, as it were. And when it comes to domestic politics in terms of being not a Democratic or Republican issue, certainly the Trump administration says, well, here's how far we are willing to go as a White House and as a party in supporting Israel. This is much farther than any side has been willing to go. And it is clearly directed at the Trump base, as much of his actions
are,
much of his policy is.
Were basically the audience for quite a lot of this announcement.
And even when you look at the announcement and how it was staged, to have the Vice President Mike Pence standing behind Trump, I think that's significant in that Pence is sort of the ambassador, if you will, between the Trump administration and the evangelical community. He is the most staunch and pious member of that administration. To have him standing there representing the administration in conjunction with the president at that moment is a clear message to that base.
And Philippe, just finally, I mean, it's a fascinating point, isn't it, that sometimes when journalists like us are outside America, people say, oh, well, the reason that America takes this position or that position on Israel is because there's a gigantic sort of Jewish lobby that controls politics, which we know here is a ridiculously kind of simplistic, exaggerated idea. But also, actually, when you look at opinion polls of American voters, Jewish Americans are not, in fact, the most ferocious supporters of this kind of policy. It's, as Michael was saying, the evangelical Christians, kind of very right. conservative Christians, are much firmer supporters of the conservative government in Israel yeah. than Jewish Americans here. How does that...
There is a theological reason, I think, is that they share the belief that a Jewish domination of Jerusalem will help the second coming of the Messiah. And it's a very literal interpretation of the Bible, but they widely believe that. You have also to note that, I mean, the Congress, the U.S. Congress has been quite irresponsible in this on this issue for quite some time, I mean 25 years, because they thought that they could do anything, show their commitment, you know, to supporting Israel and flattering this evangelical base, because there would always be a responsible president not to act according to the law they just had adopted. And, well, we are in a different situation now.
So the checks and balances. Michael, let's turn to a story which could have been a much worse tragedy. You had a failed suicide bombing by someone who'd sort of built their own bomb. A Bangladeshi man tried to blow himself up in the middle of New York City. Now, unfortunately, those kind of events are all too familiar. What was a bit less familiar was the way that the President of the United States jumped on this failed terrorist attack to try and make a very domestic political argument about immigration laws. And we haven't seen that from previous presidents. But what did Donald Trump do after this failed suicide bombing?
Oh, it was a failed pipe bombing in New York City subways. And it was attempted by someone who had come into the country on what is known by some as chain migration. And he was a sibling of a naturalized citizen who had immigrated to the United
States. So this is the
idea
that if one person gets a green card, then actually they can bring in quite a lot of members of their own family.
Theoretically, this is and this is the issue that it is a possibility is what President Trump came out against, that this should not be a possibility, that there should be much stronger vetting, and that lineage and family should not be one of the criteria by which you bring people into the country. It should be almost exclusively about earning potential, job skills, language skills, these sorts of things, your potential to be a part of a quote-unquote strong economy. And I believe the bill they have in the Congress about that, the Republican bill, talks about just economic growth, the potential for this. The reason it was interesting, though, is that the Trump administration mostly has talked about illegal immigration and talking about the southern border in Mexico and that sort of thing. And this one is particularly about legal immigration. And when you look at legal immigration in the United States, it is extremely difficult to get into the United States. And this person came in on what's called the fourth exception, I believe, or the fourth case, which is as a sibling. People in that case, in that category, generally it takes about 13 years to come into the country, which is a long time. And then after that, it's another maybe 5 or 6 years before you get a green card or citizenship. So I think to say that this person, to look at this case and say that we have to close this off because this one person happened to do this. When we're talking about 65,000 people that came in overall last year, there's still 2.5 million waiting in line. We're talking about a problem probably that really doesn't exist.
Of course, Philippe, it's an interesting point of history, but America is unusual in having this system of immigration where you build off from one person who gets the green card and then you start inviting in members of their family. But of course, the historical reason for that was members of Congress believed that that would keep Africans and Asians out of the country. The idea was to allow lots of Europeans to enter the country. And the theory was that Africans and Asians wouldn't have family members already here. And so you can look at speeches in Congress when they passed this law decades ago saying this will keep it to good Europeans who already have family here. But is there a deliberate attempt to blur the issues of immigration and terrorism by this administration, do you think? Or is there a genuine security case to be made that chain migration is a risk for terrorism?
The immigration rules in this country will be changed, and that's not because there was this failed terror attack in New York. It's because the American people elected Donald Trump. And as Michael said, he campaigned on illegal immigration, but the real policies, the core of the reforms regarding immigration are on legal immigration. And this is something that is at the heart of his mandate, of the reason why his voters have put him in the White House. I think there is no chance that it's not changed. That is, this system is not entirely reviewed by this administration. And you have to reckon that some countries are considered quite democratic countries with a system that it's much tougher, that controls its border, that give the advantage to chosen immigration.
Well, let me ask you, I mean, you're a journalist for the big French newspaper, Le Figaro. You come from France, which is a country where you have had an anti-immigrant far-right party doing, you know, quite well in recent elections. For our listeners outside America, if they think, well, America is a country which is, you know, built on immigration, you have people on the right who've always said illegal immigration we don't like, but something different, legal immigration, if people come the right way, they come here to get jobs, that's what built America. That's always made American politics a bit different from European politics, where it was easier to say, you know, these people don't look like French people or these people don't look like British people, and you could have an argument just about immigration. It wasn't only legal or illegal. It was just all immigration was seen as a kind of a potent thing. You're a French journalist working in America. Does American politics feel and sound a bit more like European politics now in terms of views of immigration as a good or a bad thing?
I think it's evolving that way, yes, in that direction. Probably 2 or 3 years from now, the U.S. immigration system will look a lot more like European system. And Europe hasn't had a chosen immigration. I mean, it's largely a myth. We are also overwhelmed by some issues about how we control the flows, how we choose willing people coming to the country. Every democracy right now is confronted to that, and I think we'll see a lot of changes in the US.
And we'll expand on that when we come back from a short break.
More of Issues in the News in just a moment. This program is coming to you on the Voice of America in Washington. And a reminder that Issues in the News is available for free download on iTunes. Just click on the iTunes tab on our website at voanews.com. And don't forget to like us on Facebook. Current Affairs with Carol Castiel. Now back to our panel. Philippe Jalli, U.S. Chief Correspondent for Le Figaro, and Michael Williams, CBS Radio News contributor. Our moderator is David Rennie, Washington Bureau Chief for The Economist.
So let's turn, Michael, to the southern state of Alabama, which is a very, very conservative state. It has been electing Republicans for a long time, ever since basically the Republicans became the party that opposed...
The Southern Strategy of Nixon.
That opposed sort of civil rights for African Americans. Mm-hmm. Let's not be kind of, you know, mealy-mouthed about it. There was a surprise this week. What happened in this special election to elect a new United States senator in Alabama?
Well, in likely the most red state, the most partisan Republican state in the entire country, Roy Moore, the candidate, the Republican candidate, lost to the Democrat, Doug Jones, becoming the first Democratic senator, I believe, in 25 years to win there. The election was between Doug Jones, who is a fairly innocuous candidate. I still couldn't tell you what he's for or against, but he was basically running against Roy Moore, who even before the sexual allegations that came out against him about dealing with minor-aged young girls, was maybe the most flawed candidate of my political life.
So let's go through. Let's tell listeners. So Roy Moore, the Republican candidate for the Senate, he believed that Muslims should not be allowed to be members of Congress. That should be the law.
That they cannot be because they have to swear on a Bible, which is not true.
He believed that gay people should be illegal.
Yes.
And if needs to be, they should be put in prison.
Correct.
He believed that the Bible should be above the United States Constitution in terms of legal hierarchy.
In fact, he believes that everything after the 10th Amendment to the Constitution, all the rest of the amendments should be erased, which includes voting rights and enfranchisement for African Americans and for women.
So, Philippe, you know, some people used to say that you could basically elect a fence post a Republican in Alabama. Did the Republicans basically just choose the one man in Alabama who could not get elected, or was there a Trump effect as well?
I think there is a Trump effect, definitely. First of all, you have to notice that, as Michael said, we don't know much about Doug Jones, but we knew that he was in favor of abortion, which should have been a huge impediment to his campaign and his election. He was lucky enough to have an opponent whose flows were even higher and bigger, and so he overcame that. What we see, there are plenty of lessons. I mean, it was a very special election with peculiar candidates and a lot of money. I mean, Doug Jones overflowed Roy Moore 6-1 in terms of money, I think.
Because lots of national Democrats were sending donations.
Yeah, exactly.
Into this race.
There are so many lessons that both Democrats and Republicans and the president, by the way, can draw from this. And one of them is that the president's popularity with part of the electorate is not that easily transferable to any other candidate.
That's exactly
right. And that's a lesson for 2018. That's a huge setback for Steve Bannon, the strategist, who has launched a war against establishment Republicans.
So this is the political advisor to Donald Trump who recently left the White House and announced that he was going to try and elect people like Donald Trump, people who are just as fiery and as sort of furious as Donald Trump across the country. And that didn't work out for him.
It didn't work out because what is exactly this populism that Bannon is trying to promote? Is it a kind of nihilism, an anarchy? You can do anything as long as you pretend that you will support Donald Trump.
Michael, let's talk about the role of two voter blocks in Alabama. One is African Americans, who in a state like Alabama have not had a lot of political power and so have not really had much reason to vote because it didn't change a great deal. But they turned out in very large numbers, comparatively large numbers this time. And also, white women who went to college, educated white women, maybe living in suburbs rather than in very, very rural areas, a lot of whom voted for Donald Trump but seemed to not be willing to vote for Roy Moore, this man who, as you say, didn't even think women should get the vote. Do you think that national politicians are looking very carefully at those two voter blocks and the role that they played in Alabama?
Yes, especially the Democratic Party, because these are the voting blocks that have traditionally carried them since that Southern strategy came to be. As we move into the urban and the suburban areas, these are the votes that have been the most reliable. And they did not come out in the 2016 election. Democrats got Donald Trump elected, those who didn't show up and those who flipped and voted for him. I would say that the only Democrat that Roy Moore could have beaten in Alabama was Hillary Clinton. You know, I say everybody runs against Hillary Clinton now, so that's what you really have to do. And look, yes, the educated white voter and the African-American voter came out, especially the African-American voter, who came out in numbers that exceeded the numbers that came out to vote for Barack Obama in both elections. Now, stop and consider that, you know, as a as a benchmark. This is a huge turnout. And this is a canary in the coal mine, I think, for the Trump administration and Trumpism in general. And you talk about what is this populism? I think this shows the difference between populism and popularity. Mm-hmm. Donald Trump is popular. Populism doesn't necessarily get you elected.
That's fascinating. Let's turn finally to just checking in on the long-running investigation into the idea that Russian spies tried to interfere in the 2016 election, which American intelligence services say they absolutely did. The question is, were they trying to help Donald Trump, and were they being helped by the Trump campaign? So we have Robert Mueller, a special counsel, former head of the FBI, investigating. So Michael and Philippe, we're old enough to remember, because we were alive in May of this year, that there was a time when Republicans and Democrats said, Robert Mueller, what a fantastic man. Both parties said, a distinguished man, appointed by George W. Bush, worked for Barack Obama, fantastic man, we trust him. Suddenly, you turn on conservative television the last 2 weeks, and Robert Mueller is trying to launch a coup d'etat against Donald Trump. Donald Trump should fire Robert Mueller. You had a Fox News host calling him the head of the snake. This kind of conspiracy against the president. What's going on?
So it is kind of fascinating to see how someone's position in the world can change so very, very quickly. I guess the only person who's changed even faster was James Comey. We saw the same thing with one side saying that he was completely for Hillary, and then all of a sudden he's
completely
against.
And what's the evidence that these Mueller bashers are citing?
What they're looking at is a couple of things. We're looking at basically the staffing of Mueller's committee, the people who were working with him on this investigation. There were two staffers, one lawyer and one agent, who apparently had passed some personal emails between the two of them, or text messages between the two of them, where there were some disparaging comments about Trump. This was during the campaign period. And apparently both of them were working both on the Hillary Clinton email investigation and for a period of time on the Russia investigation. Mueller found out about that, removed them both from, and I think this is an important point, when he found out, they were removed. This text message exchange became public, and now it's being used as the basis for a Republican claim that the entire investigation is tainted, that there are a bunch of partisans led by the ultimate partisan Mueller, who is in fact a registered Republican, who is leading this witch hunt against the Trump administration.
So, Philippe, very briefly in the time we have left, if you start to think, well, goodness, maybe they are building up to fire Robert Mueller or to try to shut down this investigation. Again, you know, in ancient history, 3 months ago, people like us used to say, well, even Republican members of Congress will not tolerate Donald Trump firing the man investigating his campaign. It would be too blatant a move. When you look at some of the Republican rhetoric attacking Robert Mueller, and as Michael said, attacking members of his own investigation team, are you now still 100% convinced that the Mueller investigation is going to be allowed to run its course, or do you think that we're now in very strange territory?
We are in very strange territory. Nothing is 100% sure with this administration. I think Donald Trump is receiving a lot of bad advice from elected Republicans. I think he's receiving good advice of being prudent from his lawyers. So far, he has followed them. I think if he fires Robert Mueller, first of all, he will have to fire very high officials at the Department of Justice, just as Richard Nixon did in 1974. And we know where it led him. This time, maybe with someone like Donald Trump, he could get away with it in Congress. I think he would pay for it in the polls.
Michael, a last very quick question. When Richard Nixon finally, the final tape was revealed, there was a moment where even Republicans said, you know what, we're done, he has to go. Is that moment possibly going to happen again? Or do you think this country is now so divided that there is a chunk of this country that will never accept any finding from the Mueller investigation if they do accuse the Trump inner circle?
Both answers are true. And when Richard Nixon got on the helicopter, he still had 32% approval, you know, from part of this country. So it wasn't unanimous. But I do think that Michael Flynn and Paul Manafort will be heard, and there will be something.
These are two close Trump advisors who have now been indicted.
Yes, and I think that those will be the things that what they have to say may be the quote-unquote smoking gun.
Well, thank you very much. That's all we have time for today. Thanks to Michael Williams, CBS Radio contributor, and Philippe Gelly, US chief correspondent for Le Figaro. This program is produced by VOA's Current Affairs. Our engineer is Justin Thwaites, and I'm David Rennie of The Economist. Thanks for listening.